Welcome back, readers and romance seekers, to Hopelessly Romantic Behind the Page. I'm just going to say that I'm feeling better, and so I hope that you all are feeling good this week. But let's not dally on it. I want to talk about a Duke at the Door one more time before we move on. So yeah, we're really just going to dive into it. So one aspect of A Duke at the Door that I didn't really talk about last week was how different all three stories were in the series as a whole, but they still kind of built on one another. A big theme was a lot of payoff in our novel. We saw things that were hinted at and suggested in the first and second books, and then we got to see those to fruition in the third book. A really good example would be himself. The way they kind of talked about himself, it didn't really suggest that he would have been Versipellis, but we kind of were able to imply that he was Versipellis, and we were proven correct in this novel. Another one would be the author, Anne Tirota Asquith, I think. She was recommended to Felicity to be read even before she knew what Versipellis was. And then we find out that the author is herself Versipellis, and she's been writing these really questionable stories about these evil shape-shifting, you know, rich people and fainting ladies. It's very weird. But, you know, they're either loved or hated in the Versipellian community. It's really funny. We finally get to see her, and yeah, she's up to no good. Something I didn't really have a lot of space to mention was that she's wearing dragon skin gloves. The gold is a danger to Versipellins. We learn that with our Duke. Oh gosh. We learned that with our Duke in question. He had been transformed into his lion self forever with a gold chain, because that curses and traps Versipellins in their shape. And she has been the one that has been capturing Versipellin folks and keeping them in their forms. And it kind of turns out that she's been wearing dragon skin gloves in order to protect herself from the danger of gold itself. And she had an assistant with her named Drake. So I'm pretty gosh darn sure that he might be an actual dragon. I don't know. I would hope that he's not the one that she got the gloves from. But you can't just say dragons exist in this world and then have everyone say, oh, dragons are only a myth. I can't believe that's really true. And then you introduce a character named Drake. It's like, yeah, that's dragon. That's a dragon, guys. But I do wonder how that will have an impact in future books as time goes on. Yeah, and I really do like that kind of continuity in books. And the other thing that this series has going on is just how different they all were, and they're still building on each other, like I was saying. Like, for instance, our first novel, A Wolf in Duke's Clothing, cared more about the Regency marriage rules. Like, that was the central drama. And it also added some inheritance mystery as well. Our second novel, A Most Unusual Duke, that was more concerned with ancestral heritage and then moving on from past trauma as well. Both Arthur and Beatrice had tragedies in their past, and they, you know, they stuck with each other to figure out how to move past it for each other, and they were able to get to a better place. A Duke at the Door, it still kind of continued that theme of trauma and overcoming past trauma, but it approached it from a completely different direction. It didn't have anything to do with inheritance or Regency marriage laws, but it was really its own story, and it also happened to tie up a few loose ends from the other novels. Every heroine is different as well. We've got Felicity, just about to age out of the marriage market. We have Beatrice, a widow, and Tabitha, an herbalist, who is basically a spinster by any other name. Yes, these are attributes. They have absolutely nothing to do with our characters as far as like their personalities go, but because we're reviewing romance novels, the points have a purpose. I will say for myself, I've placed all three of these books on the Gold Star shelf, but the first one with Alfred and Felicity, it's still my top favorite. At the time, I didn't know what I was going to get out of that book, and I was pretty much delighted with every single page. with the subsequent follow-ups, I knew what I was getting. It was just a matter of if they were up to my expectations or not. And for the most part, they were. Neither one hit as hard as the first one did, and I did have to take that into account when I was reading them and reviewing them. But really, what kind of made these all three books stand out was their approach to sex. So in the case of The Duke at the Door, Tabitha is our most experienced out of the three. Felicity from A Wolf in Duke's Clothing, she was a virgin. And Beatrice from A Most Unusual Duke, she had no actual education in sexual matters. It's actually established that her quote-unquote sex with her late husband was barely just that at the basest of definitions. Tabitha had taken lovers herself, but of course none were up to par with Duke Alwyn. Of course not. But she also had the most matter-of-fact approach to the act of sex itself, which I thought added an extra layer of amusement to the whole experience. I mentioned how she was using like the scientific terms for body parts. It was really funny and perfectly in character for her, and it didn't bother me at all. I thought it was great. Yeah, because it's coupled with her medical background, she had no shame and therefore made no apologies. And I thought that was really great. Too often do we see like, oh, I feel so dirty for having these thoughts and like all these romantic heroines. And just like, come on, you're an adult. It's fine. All three of these novels were obsessed with the woman's pleasure. Beatrice had the roughest go of it, but Felicity and Tabitha were comfortable enough with themselves to be able to enjoy masturbation. I've said it before, I will say it again, there is not enough female masturbation in these erotic novels, so we have to do everything in our power to get more of it. Frankly, we could probably see more male masturbation. With as little as we see female masturbation, because like we have this inherent idea socially that women should not be giving themselves pleasure. The act of a guy giving himself pleasure, that's like almost shameful. It's shameful and degrading because, oh my gosh, he can't even get a girl. He can't even get a date. So he's reduced to using his hand. That is stupid and bullshit. We need more instances of self-pleasuring because it's important for us to feel good, to continue living like people. and there should be no shame associated with it. Like, again, if you're not hurting anybody, who cares? If anything, it can show that our characters are genuinely becoming attracted to each other. Felicity and Tabitha, they were thinking of their prospective dukes when they were engaging in their self-pleasuring. So wouldn't it be really kind of cool for us to see the guy is doing the same thing, that he just cannot stop himself from thinking how sexy his love interest is. And oh my gosh, he's got to do something about it because she's just so sexy, but he can't really engage on those thoughts yet. So he's got to do things for himself. And it might help motivate him just like, oh my gosh, I want to pursue her. I want to woo her. And I want to be with her. And really, we need more of it. We need more of this because it's human. It is human nature. I would like to see more human nature in the novels. Also, can we talk about the fact that we have been seeing this very normal human activity in paranormal Regency romance than most of the other, quote, normal novels? Can we talk about this? Like, come on. Maybe the freedom of the genre allows the author to push bigger boundaries than, you know, what somebody might be willing to push in the cookie cutter Harlequin novels. Ooh, here I go, roasting Harlequin again. Anyway, by the way, speaking of normal, there was an aspect of queer representation that I don't think I mentioned in the episode itself. See what I did there? Because normal is just people being people, and people are queer. So, you know, whatever. So we have respective gay characters, Gambon, Tim, I think Bates. I'm pretty sure it's Bates. They're all well and good. And I am desperately hoping for their stories. Oh gosh, please give me the romances to make them happy. But I also didn't really talk about Omara a lot. I got the impression that Omara is not exactly female presenting. I mean, in the novel, they were using feminine pronouns to refer to her, but we clearly got the impression that she does not wear feminine clothing at all. Felicity followed her and like, oh my gosh, I can wear pants because Omara's wearing pants. And if Alfred says anything, I'm just going to point at Omara. And she really doesn't conform to feminine gender performance, like, at all. There was a contention of the word, of the use of the word Miss, M-I-S-S, in front of her name. People would call her Miss Omara. Tabitha, being extraordinarily empathic, she was able to pick up on this. She would tell characters, like, I think the point, like, one of the things that she doesn't like is people calling her Miss. I don't think she likes that. So I'm getting the impression that Omara is, at the very least, gender nonconforming, if not simply non-binary. At the risk of running away with this, I was introduced to the idea of non-binary genders in an intro to anthropology class in college. We discussed third genders, as they were called, as part of our, you know, cultural anthropology discussions. We would talk about, you know, cultural touchstones such as the Two-Spirit people living in Native American First Nation tribes and other peoples here in North America. I had never heard of anything like that. I knew of transgender individuals, people who went from male to female or female to male. I didn't realize that there was an in-between. But I was very understanding of the concept. I don't know why, it just kind of clicked for me. I'm solidly cisgender. I am female, born and bred, AFAB, as they call, you know, assigned female at birth. But I also know and love so many trans folks that I guess the concept didn't really cause me a lot of confusion. Like, oh, okay, you're not male or female. Sure. What else? You tell me your gender and we're good. And I think a lot of people in that class in particular had a hard time grasping the concept of anything outside the gender binary. I don't know why this is, but I think a good way to fix this problem is, oh, wow, more representation. Who'd have thunk? Oh yeah, big surprise. I am one of those woke SJWs, and if you've got a problem with that, then fuck off, I guess. But at any rate, eyebrows were raised on my end when it was suggested that Omara might possibly be non-binary, if not gender non-conforming. Gender is a social structure, y'all. It's the sooner we get over our hang-ups about it, the faster people can do whatever they want. The faster men can get around to actually having fun with how they dress, and they don't have to run out and buy kilts just for the excuse to wear a skirt. You have any idea how comfortable dresses and skirts are? Everyone should have that opportunity. I wholly endorse men wearing skirts and kilts because they feel nice and they look great. Anyway, I don't think I have much else. I'm sure that I do. Oh yeah. This book was bigger than the other two. I was surprised. I really didn't even notice until I put it on the bookshelf. I was, oh wow, it's huge comparatively speaking. There was a lot more in it, and a lot more that I couldn't go over, but you know, it was fun. But anyway, I don't have much more than that. My brain is basically Swiss cheese right now, and I think it ran away from me in general. So we're just gonna go ahead and just move right on forward into what Heather read this week. You all might remember that last time I picked up The Martian by Andy Weir so I could prepare myself for his latest novel, Project Hail Mary. And I think that was an existential terror I don't think I was prepared for. I highly recommend you go into this book spoiler-free, so stop right now if you want to read Project Hail Mary. Stop right. I will be here when you get back. I will be here when you get back. Do not go further. Do not pass go. Do not collect $200. Go to the bookstore. Get the book. Read it now. That is your spoiler warning. Because I have been told that going into Project Hail Mary as blind as you possibly could was the best experience. So that's what I did. I didn't look up anything about the book. I just saw that people were talking about Project Hail Mary, and then don't look for anything about this book. Go in completely blind. We can infer that it's going to be a stressful novel, I guess, based on the title itself, Project Hail Mary. Hail Mary is something that you do as a last-ditch effort to save your ass. So something big is going down. The big bare-bones problem is that basically there's something happening to the sun, and they got to figure out what's going on with the sun, because if they don't, they're all going to die. At the center of the story is this science teacher, a middle school science teacher, and he happened to be like an old PhD candidate, and he basically turned himself into an academic social pariah by suggesting that life doesn't necessarily need water to survive. It turns out that some of his work is actually relevant to what's happening right now. So he gets recruited by this big old organization that now has total global authority over anything and everyone. And he helps them develop a program that allows them to figure out a way to send a manned space crew to a faraway star that is not experiencing the same degradation that the sun is and other stars like it. So they have to figure out what's going on with that star. The problem is that it is a one-way trip. The people who go on that expedition are not going to come home because they just don't have the energy to do it. Basically, they select astronauts who are prepared for the sacrifice, and they have certain qualities that make them good for this mission. And they're also chosen with genetic markers because they have to put these people in a coma for 4 years. Otherwise, you know, 4 years in a box with three other people, or two other people, I guess, and it's a suicide mission. That's not going to do well for your psyche. So go to sleep and then wake up immediately later. So yeah. Well, one of the people gets basically unalived, I suppose, by a complete accident. And unfortunately, there is no one else to take their place except our poor middle school teacher. So he ends up on this ship. Problem is he's not going to remember why he's on the ship. He is injected with this sort of, not a truth serum, I guess, but it's like a sort of memory drug, because he is not wanting to go onto the ship. He does not sign up for this mission because he is a existential coward, like myself. It doesn't want to die. It's just, unfortunately, he's got that genetic marker, and oops, he has to go because he's the best person for the job because he worked at the very beginning of this project. So when he wakes up on the ship, he's got to figure out from scratch who he is, what he's doing, why he's doing it. And unfortunately, the two crewmates that were supposed to be with him did not survive. Great. So essentially, it's a lot of problem solving. If you like The Martian and its problem solving aspect, you're going to get more of that. So woohoo, great, congratulations. It's still different, though. It's how to describe it. It's just different. I like it. But what actually gives you a real twist, again, if you don't want spoilers, stop here. What gives you a real twist is that actual aliens are involved this time. The alien in question is, it gets the name Rocky because they're like walking rocks with legs. It's kind of interesting. But it's kind of cool. And it's really great. And apparently they have like a sort of musical language. So I needed to hear like Rocky's language like yesterday. If I were to compare the two stories between The Martian and Project Hail Mary, I think I like The Martian a little bit more. Mostly because Mark Watney, while he is alone on the planet, he knows that he's basically got the entirety of the Earth rooting for him and trying to get him home. In the case of Project Hail Mary, our main character, he's not gonna come home. at least as far as he understands. He's pretty not great dealing with this. That kind of gave me a little bit of existential terror that I hate. It was great. Loved it. And he was pretty alone for a lot of it. Even though Rocky was there, he still didn't, you know, have that hope of getting home. And he also has the pressure of having the entire human race on his back. Like, they're rooting for him only because they're gonna die if he loses. So it's harder, I think, emotionally. There is humor in there. That's not in question. But I prefer The Martian in execution, if I'm being perfectly honest. One other thing that it's different from The Martian is that The Martian is just straightforward and you're focused almost entirely on one guy. There are a couple of areas where that are interjected with people working on Earth, but for the most part, it's all about Watney. It's the Watney show. You can see in Project Hail Mary, he slowly gets his memories back through flashbacks, so it kind of blends the narrative a little bit. And you're getting the flashbacks at the same time as he's remembering these. He's like, oh, okay, that's what's going on. Got it. Okay. I still need to read his Artemis novel. I've heard that that's all right. And I do like Andy Weir's work. He does really fun writing. So I'm pretty interested in checking out Artemis. But I think that's going to be it for me this week. I will catch you next week when we read Katie's Catch by J.J. Sommers. Thank you for joining me, readers and romance seekers, and I hope to see you once again for Hopelessly Romantic. If you like the show, please visit us at hopelesslyromanticpodcast.com. If you have questions or want to recommend a read, please email us at contact@hopelesslyromanticpodcast.com. Also, please leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. It will go a long way to help the show, and I can keep bringing you lots of fun episodes. The show is written and produced by me, Heather Songster. Our technical advisor is Kwang Yun Cho. Hopelessly Romantic is an H with K production. And it doesn't matter what you read, only that it's what you love.